Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture.
Comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends.
Pop.
This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 86 of the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason along with Sue Kalinske. We are recording this on a sunny Saturday, November the 21st at 12 o'clock noon. And our guest is one of the stars on the long-running series Superstore. She also has a really funny podcast called True Crime and Cocktails. Lauren Ash joins us. Lauren, thanks a lot for coming on. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. So I'm curious. You know, we've consumed a whole bunch of your stuff, listened to your podcast, and I caught up on Superstore. I got stoned and caught up on Superstore last night,
which
just as funny, just as funny that way. You started out in improv, Second City in Toronto, and then Second City in Chicago. Did you do like improv stuff as a kid?
You know, from a very young age, I was very into like make-believe games, certainly. And I remember I used to like direct my friends about what, like I would improvise for all of us. I remember like I would come up with lines for everybody. And then in high school, we did what we thought was improv, but what we would do is get like 10 suggestions from the audience. Then we would like huddle for a good 5 minutes, which must have been just, you know, very compelling to watch as an audience member, I'm sure. And then we would somehow try and weave together these, you know, multitudes of suggestions at once, which again, it was improv in a sense, but long story short, basically, I think I was trying to do it, but it wasn't until I actually went to theater school and there was an improv component of our, you know, curriculum. And that's when I really was like, oh my gosh, I love this. And I hate everything else here. And so I actually quit theater school after about 4 months and walked to the Second City in Toronto and signed up for classes because I was like, that was the thing that really, you know, spoke to me the most. And let's see how this goes. And listen, it worked out. So it's great.
Did you always think I'm going to be in show business?
I did from a very young age. I think I was cast in my first school play when I was in like fourth grade, and they cast me as the lead, which was, I'm sure, a giant upset because there was much older children that probably thought that they deserved it more than me. But yeah, it's just kind of always been there. Certainly from fourth grade, third, fourth grade on, I was just like, this is kind of just it. So it was, which is kind of nice when you just like make a strong decision.
Yeah,
and
when
then
you just
really
know.
See it through. Yeah, exactly.
So were your parents encouraging?
Oh, gosh, my mom is like encouraging, I would say almost to a fault. Some would say, you know, vicariously living through me. I'm kidding, but seriously. My mom is like super supportive. And she's actually an actress herself and was quite good. She was really heavily involved in our community theater in my hometown, and she's won acting awards and stuff like that. So when I communicated like any, you know, vague interest in performing, she was like, we're doing it, let's go. You know, so I started in community theater, and then when I was in high school, she managed to somehow find me an agent, and we used to drive, because I grew up in a small town east of Toronto, we used to drive 2 hours to Toronto for me to go to auditions for like, you know, crappy commercials or music videos or whatever. But then I actually booked a big one for Tylenol, which was a pretty big deal. And then I booked a second one. And here's the joke. My mom went in as well, and she also booked the commercial.
Wow.
So, oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah, true story.
So when I was in high school, I worked in the theater program, and I remember my dream role, the one that they're still talking about back in Maumee, Ohio, is my version of Henry Higgins. I still will sometimes sing those songs, imagining that my career had gone differently. What was your big high school role that you remember playing?
Well, there was two. The big one in the theater, like the community theater in my hometown, there was a play called On the Razzle, which was like a very typical British farce. And I was playing the lead, which was a boy's part. But obviously, I was a teenage girl. I had a short haircut at the time, so I guess it worked. But I guess that was quite common, you know, in like traditional farce. So for some reason in you know, small town Canada, they were like, we have to be true to the art form. We've got to cast a girl in this boy role. I don't know. But that was a pretty big deal because it was like a buddy comedy with myself and an older gentleman. And I remember like we took that one pretty far. Like I think that we we went to like into like awards contention for that and stuff like that. So that was definitely like my biggest one, I would say, in high school. But at my high school, I also was one of the leads in a musical called Suds. Now, what's Suds, you ask?
Yeah.
It is a loosely woven together series of series of scenes that connects existing like 1950s, 60s music. But of course, they didn't want to pay for the rights for that music. So every song is just slightly off. So I played one of the three leads in that. And it's funny because when I hear those songs to this day, if I hear them on the radio or somewhere, I start singing along, and then I realize, oh my gosh, I've memorized this, the alt version, right? So like when I hear it playing, I'm like, wait a minute, that's not the melody line in this song. And it's like, oh no, that's the actual melody, Lauren. You were just singing the alternative one so that they didn't have to pony up the bucks.
Sue, did you do plays?
No, but you know, when I was a kid, I did impressions at a very, very young age. So
I love
what do you remember? What do you remember? What do you got?
Well, you know, I did John Kennedy. Because there was an album that came out called The First Family that Buck Henry and a group of like hysterical writers, it was a spoof on The First Family. And it was playing in my house constantly. So, you know, there was one scene where John was giving a tour of the White House, and he goes into the bathroom and he's looking at all the toys in the bathtub. And then he says, and the rubber schwan is mine. So here I was like 6 years old doing John Kennedy, and then I just did impressions, and I actually did that up until I started doing stand-up. For the first 3 years of my stand-up career, I just did impressions.
So, wow.
Yeah.
I love that.
What was your favorite character that you created at Second City?
Well, you know what? There's a couple. There was one, I think probably my most favorite, if I have to choose. There was one, and it was a teenage girl who was had a lot of physical ailments. Like, and kind of like the running joke through the scene was that like anytime anybody brought something up, it connected to one of her physical ailments. But the scene was between her and her boyfriend, and they are going through a breakup because it's revealed partway through the scene that he was imaginary and that she had made him up, and that she was having to break it to him that he actually wasn't a real person and that he was an imaginary friend or imaginary boyfriend in this case. And it was kind of like a slow reveal throughout. And that was a scene that I had come up with that premise for. And if I look back on my Second City career, is probably the one I'm the most proud of, because when the reveal happened every night, you know, hearing the gasp of the audience as they're like, oh, like it was just like, it's like so delicious, right? When you take people on a journey and you surprise them and you get that, you know, response that in the same room. I mean, there's nothing better.
So how much has it helped being a trained improv actress? How much has that helped just acting and auditioning? I would think, how does that play in like getting roles?
Oh, it's huge. I value it more than anything. It's interesting because in acting school, again, the 3-4 months I actually spent there, they kept trying to lead us through a bunch of different exercises to have us, you know, be able to tap into emotion, and nothing worked for me. Like everything that they were suggesting just didn't work for me. And, you know, it was like, distill down a sad image, and then, you know, you can drop that image in to make yourself cry. And I was like, this isn't working for me. But when I started doing improv, I actually personally felt like it opened me up emotionally, like being in the moment and just playing the moment as a character. I felt like I was much more able to kind of tap into those emotions and cry or whatever, just like being in the moment and kind of, you know, feeling what the character is. So I think it's made me a much better actor. It's been the way that I've been able to kind of, you know, draw on emotions in work. And B, in terms of auditioning, absolutely. Like being able to be loose and in the moment and just kind of like riff, I think is such a huge asset. And personally, whenever I audition to this day, I always add things to scripts. I always either come up with other jokes ahead of time, or I add stuff in the moment in the room, and people are like, isn't that risky? And I'm like, yeah, but it's paid off thus far.
right.
You gotta swing big to win big, you know what I mean? So
yeah, totally.
I always encourage people, like, they're gonna hear the same audition, you know, 200 times that day. Do something memorable. What's the worst that can happen?
Well, you know, I remember, you know, early in my stand-up career, you know, I used to go out for a lot of commercials, and they always wanted comedians to come in because a lot of the times they wanted the comic to come up with basically the copy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they want you to write it for them. Absolutely.
They want you to write it for them. And I remember, you know, going in and not getting, you know, a handful of them, and then kind of getting pissed off when I saw the commercial and saw some of the stuff that I came up with in the commercial.
Oh, yeah. No, that's notorious. I remember that as well when I was doing a lot of commercial auditioning back in the day. And yeah, that has not changed. Yeah.
So when you auditioned for the role of Dina on Superstar, did you already have that sort of character in your head, or was it an adjustment, or how did it all work?
When I read the pilot script for Superstore, I was like, oh my gosh, I know her. I know this character. I've been playing this character for years. So there was a character I developed while I was at the Second City. It never made a show. So Second City, we use improv to write scenes, and the show is two acts of scripted material and then one act of improv. So she never got into a scene that actually made it to the show, but I would play her in improv sets quite often. And it's basically Dina. It's extremely close. And so when I read that pilot, I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is my part. Like, no one else can play this. And I'm Canadian. So like, I'm, you know, we're barely confident. We're, you know, humble at best. But with this thing, I was like a dog, like a bone. So I started calling my manager literally every day. And I was like, when's my Superstore audition? And I'm sure I was so annoying. And he was like, they haven't seen anybody yet. And I was like, I want in there on day one. And yeah, sure enough, I went in, and it was a long audition process for me. I ended up auditioning for that thing 4 times by the end. Huh. Whereas some of my co-stars, I might add, only had to audition like once and then once on tape. And I was doing live auditions all the way through.
They were just entertained with you.
Yeah, really. Yeah. They just couldn't get enough of you.
Listen, it was great. And I remember, you know, again, like, I'm never really cocky, but with that role, I was just like, this is just mine and I know it. And I was right.
Dina is so uptight and she's so intense, and you are absolutely nothing like that. Is there a particular person that you're channeling or somebody in mind?
I think it's a kind of a confluence of a few people. I think that there are those people. We've all met Dina in real life. You know what I mean? Yep. And currently, like, people love
my mother.
Right? Like, we all know somebody who is like her. And people love to tag me in social media, especially now that TikTok is a thing. They love to tag me in videos of, like, you know, Target employees that are exactly like Dina. And listen, quite often I'm like, oh, they're bang on. But I think for me, it was more that archetype. I don't know that it was one specific person. I think I drew from quite a few. But it's, yeah, I just feel like we all know a Dina. We all know that woman that's like that. And people always ask, you know, are you like her in real life? And I'm not, as you said, but I do think that the one thing we share is that I also appreciate the rules. I'm just not a psycho about it. I like myself to follow the rules. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
other people can do what you want, but I like to be by the book.
are you given the freedom to kind of go off and improvise?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We improvise every day. I mean, we always get the scene as it's scripted, and then inevitably there will probably also be a few, like, you know, for key jokes in a scene, the writers will come up with, like, multiple alt jokes, so we'll probably get a bunch of those. But we always do passes where we just improvise basically every scene, and they use a lot of it, too. So it's been, like, it's such a creatively fulfilling gig, you know? I mean, getting a TV gig is like the best, but, you know, no questions asked. But when you are also able to feel like you're contributing creatively and that you're really a part of creating this show together, I mean, it's the ultimate dream. I mean, it's such a joy to be a part of.
You know, the show, you know, Steve and I were actually talking before we went on the air about how we don't normally watch network television. And
you were a little snobby that way, Lauren.
Oh, yeah. No, listen, I get it.
Well, and you know, I'm just so, like, so thrilled with the show because it is so funny and so silly and so racy. And some of the things you guys get away with.
Yeah, I'm always surprised, too. I'm always like, is the network going to allow this? They are? Oh, okay, great. But, you know, I think that's what's really one of the things that I love about the show the most is that it does go to those places. So it does talk about social issues in a very realistic way. It does kind of do go to the sillier places or the racier places that you weren't expecting. But that's, if anybody's ever worked, I think any workplace is similar to that, but certainly I worked in a store like this when I was in high school. And I got to tell you, like, a lot of this stuff goes on.
Yeah. Talk about your experience of working in essentially a superstore, right?
Yeah, it was called Zellers. It no longer is a chain that exists in Canada, but I started there when I was 15 and I worked in the footwear department for 2 years. And then I got bumped up to cash, which was a real feather in my cap. But you know, honestly, like, it's such, first of all, it's such a great study of just humanity, working in that job and the unrealistic expectations that people who shop in those stores can have of the employees working in those stores. I remember people being like, why don't you know how to size children's feet? And I was like, I make $6.85 an hour. Like, I don't know what to tell you. They gave me a vest and I'm just here. Like, there's no training. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get trained to work in the footwear department. You just straighten shoes. But it's certainly, you know, it was such a full circle moment for me because that was my first job. And then booking Superstore, you know, as an adult, it's really surreal and really cool. And the one fun fact that I have is that when we shot the pilot of Superstore, it was in an existing store, but when it got picked up to series, they built us a store on stages at Universal Studios. And the first time I walked onto those stages, I was like, oh my gosh, it smells exactly like the Zellers I worked in. I'm not even kidding. I don't know how or why. I don't know if it's just like the musty, dusty product. I don't know, but I was just, it was really a wild full circle moment for me.
So I've got an issue. Sorry about that, Sue. I've got an issue with what I saw in season 6, which is the terrible breakup that is going to take me a while to get over. Amy and Jonah, who do I direct my complaint to?
Listen, I'm going to tell you something. We have some diehard fans of the show who definitely share the feelings that you have, to the point actually that when that episode aired, the Twitter fans kind of started to go into some sort of shock, and I was like, get over to Instagram, everybody. I'll do an Instagram live right now. We're gonna talk this through. And, you know, I was, but here's the thing, you know, like, I get it. Like, I am a huge fan of that relationship and I was devastated when they broke up, but, you know, I really feel, at the end of the day, I do think that it was a realistic choice. I do think that it was it's an interesting choice. And emotionally, I'm not okay either, and it's going to take time. But logically, as a viewer, I was like, you know, I do think it's an interesting choice that she is like, you know what, I'm going to follow this path, and I got to do it on my own, and that's what feels right to me. And in terms of Jonah, he deserves somebody that's all 100% in. You know, you don't want someone who's wishy-washy, and he deserves better. And I think that there are so many romantic relationships in life where, you know, circumstance and things like that do play a factor, and it's you know, it's so sad, but I do think that that kind of aligns with the kind of realism that we try and bring to some of the stories we tell. So again, I get it and I apologize, but hopefully in time we can all see that it was maybe an interesting choice.
Now, how far in advance did you know that she was leaving the show?
Well, it's an interesting story because of the COVID of it all. So last season was supposed to be the end of her story. So she had decided mid last season that it would be her last season. And so they had written, you know, that by the end of season 5, she would be gone, and season 6, we would be picking up without the Amy character there. But we did get shut down, ironically, the Friday before we were supposed to start shooting the last episode. So we had gotten kind of like the beginning of the buildup of her leaving, but then we couldn't actually shoot that last episode. So the good news was that she was able to come back for the first two so that they could kind of, A, get into the, you know, obviously the COVID pandemic wildness that is deeply affecting, obviously, Superstore employees all over the world. So it was an interesting opportunity there, but then also allowing them to kind of like figure out how to navigate ending that story, which is great because it would have been really a shame if she hadn't gotten to, you know, at least have that kind of denouement to the Amy story, you know?
So season six premiered on October the 29th, which means you must have done some shooting while the pandemic is going on, right? What kind of precautions did you have to take? When did you actually shoot? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so we were actually one of the first shows back at Universal Studios. We went back to work early September, I believe. And let me tell you, it's a whole new world. Literally everything. And it's interesting having been on the same show for 5 years, which I actually think in some ways has made this a little bit easier because it is a bit of a well-oiled machine at this point. We don't have a lot of locations when we shoot. We're in the stages in the store, you know, 99% of the time. But every single detail of how you work has changed for every department, every person. So, you know, there's tons of stuff. I mean, we're tested every day. Anyone of the actors or anyone who's in the quote shooting group is tested every day. And there's lots of rules, you know, and we're in an interesting position because we're playing the reality of the pandemic. So there is a certain amount of scenes that we shoot with our masks on, because that's if the store is functional and there's customers there, we would obviously be masked in real life. Yep. But it's wild. Like literally every possible thing you can imagine that goes into making a TV show has changed. So I commend everybody because we've managed to we're still shooting now. We have next week off, but for Thanksgiving, obviously, but we've made it this far, and we've shot 8 episodes so far, and we haven't had any issues, and we haven't had any outbreaks, and knock wood. I mean, it's weird, you know, and it's an odd situation to be in because I think, you know, we're not through this pandemic yet. If anyone's paying attention to the news, it's still here. And it's a strange thing to go to work and be like, okay, I guess we're doing this. But I'm really proud of the work that we've done and that we've been able to do it in a safe way, which is great.
And, you know, the fact that I have not seen any show that is current in dealing with the pandemic, because, you know, most of the stuff I watch has already been shot.
Right.
So when I started to see this in the show, I was like, oh my God. I mean, it was a little jarring, you know, to actually see people wearing masks, and that's part of the story. But it really was done. It really was done just beautifully. You know, I mean,
it was seamless
and, you know, it never felt like you guys were trying too hard to include it in the show. It just worked.
Yeah. And I think that's been something that has been important is, again, like, you know, the frontline workers, obviously, including people who work in these stores are really truly the heroes of the pandemic. And they are the people that allowed the rest of us to get the supplies we need to survive, and putting their lives at risk, you know, as cashiers, as stock people, as working at all of these stores. And I think it's a really great opportunity to get to kind of reflect that and reflect them and do it in a way that points out the foibles and the funny and all of that. But also, yeah, it doesn't have to hit it over the head, but just shows like this is the reality that we're living in, and this is really happening, and it's still happening. And I think it's been a really interesting opportunity going into season 6 of an existing show. I think it would be tougher to premiere a show like this at this time. I think if we were going into season 1, it would be very odd. But, you know, going into season 6, our fans, our viewers, they know us, you know, they know who we are, they know our dynamics, all of those kinds of things. So I think it's been a cool opportunity to get to just address it and be realistic in how we make the show.
So when I'm a little kid, down in the basement, there was a bookshelf, and on the bookshelf were some books. There was The Happy Hooker by Xavier Hollander, I believe was the name.
Hollander, yeah.
Yep. There was Jaws by Peter Benchley, and there was Helter Skelter. And I was forbidden by my parents to read any of these books. And the moment they pointed them out and forbade me to read them, that's when I started. And Helter Skelter, I can go back and look at that. And first of all, scared the heck out of me as a little kid. But on top of that, it's sort of the beginning of my fascination with true crime. Where did your fascination with true crime start?
It actually, I was far too young. And my when my grandparents would babysit me on, sometimes on like a Friday night, I would sneak up to their bedroom because they had like a little TV up in their bedroom, and I would watch Unsolved Mysteries, the original Unsolved Mysteries. And I was, again, like seven, like way too young.
Wow.
And I don't know what, I think they thought I was watching like TGIF up there, you know, like
Family Matters.
Exactly. The like Urkel or whatever. But no, I was watching terrifying programming. And I remember like watching and scaring myself so badly that then it was like I didn't want to walk through the dark hallway to like get to my own bedroom in that house. And but it really was, it really did start with Unsolved Mysteries. And it's funny because my co-host of my new podcast is my sister by life, cousin by blood, Chrissy Oxborough. And we discovered recently, we didn't know this, but we both were doing that at that age. We both were. Yeah. And it's only now as adults that we've managed to make this connection that we both had this fascination. And that's really where it started for the both of us.
I got to tell you, your cousin... so goddamn funny.
Right?
I've listened to other shows that do crime stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And there's some very, very popular ones out there. But the thing that I love about this show is that the relationship that the two of you have is just, bar none, the best. I mean, you know, I love your little introduction of personal stories that float in. And just, you know, it like blows my mind the research that she does.
It's amazing.
She's got case files.
Oh, yeah.
And she's got maps and she's got pictures and she's got a whole board. Like I'm watching Law and Order. It's unbelievable. Where did this come from her?
Listen, I think no one is more surprised than the both of us. But, you know, it was one of those things where, and listen, I've always known that she's an internet sleuth, don't get me wrong. But, you know, we had had this conversation. We had both seen the new Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix that had come out. And we were having this like late night drunken kind of conversation about it and about our theories. And I was like, we should do this as a podcast. And I think she kind of was like, yeah, okay. And then the thing about me is that I'm like a dog with a bone. So I'm like, if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. So we started thinking like, oh, well, let's just do like, you know, something loose, whatever. And she, I think, surprised herself at the amount that she could find and how deep that she could go. The other thing I will say is she is a voracious reader. I think she can read a lot faster than I can, for example. So almost every episode, she will find actual books and she will, you know, order them to the house and read them. And she really only has like a week to research each episode because we have to stay on a schedule so we can keep pumping them out. And it just is truly amazing to me, the details that she finds, and she always makes sure to cross-reference, so she's never going to present something that, you know, she only has one source. It has to have multiple sources backing it up. She's born for this work, and I think that that's what's been really cool is getting, you know, as a silver lining of staying at home, what we found out is that she has found her calling, certainly.
Does Netflix know that you're doing this?
I don't know. I mean, I know that they, I know I'm like waiting for the cease and desist. No, I don't know if they do. I do know that they're going to be coming out with their own podcast about these episodes. And I think about other episodes, but that's not until next year. So we're like, well, we just got to keep our heads down and keep pushing forward. But listen, I mean, lots of people have watched the show in reference to our podcast and stuff like that. So I think everybody wins.
Yeah, I just want to give a little example of the podcast.
Yeah.
So I'm new to the podcast. So I listened to Lady in the Lake, which is the most recent one.
Yeah.
And you guys figure out that this woman who allegedly got hypothermia and drowned herself, that isn't selling.
Right.
Talk about the work that Christy does in order to piece together the tea leaves to be able to figure stuff out.
One of the big things that she likes to do is background checks. And I made it clear to her at the beginning of this that I was willing to finance as many background checks as she needed to pay for. So the stuff that she found out about that episode, certainly, I think, had such a bulk of information. I know it was our longest episode yet because we were just trying to get through everything she found. But she managed to find that the victim, Joanne's brother, had legit mob ties, like tied to real mafia criminals, that he was also in immense gambling debt, and that perhaps, you know, maybe people were coming to send a message by going after his sister. Who knows? The big thing for me that she found in that one that I thought was unbelievable There was a lot. But the thing that stuck out for me was that there was witness statements that were made that the police completely dismissed. She found one from a person who said that they were driving around the area that the crime was committed at around that time, and that this person saw a man wearing a black scarf. The police completely disregarded this witness statement, saying it was incredible. But Christy cross-referenced with the evidence list from this case. And what was logged into the evidence list? A black scarf.
A black scarf.
He digs further to find out the black scarf was never tested for DNA, was never, you know, I don't know how they would, whether they look for hair or skin follicles or what, but anyway, was never properly tested. And 2 years later was donated to a Goodwill. That scarf is gone. And to me, that was such a like amazing find that, first of all, not only pokes holes in the police and their kind of bungling potentially of this case, but then it also kind of turns a darker corner where it was like, were there details here that were being, you know, mishandled deliberately, you know, and all the details she found, like the police going to her family after she had only been apparently missing 2 hours, saying your mother is missing, you know, going to the house saying we found her car. But if you run the plates of that car, it's registered to her daughter. So why would they, like, there's so many details that she managed to uncover that weren't included in the episode. It's really an amazing feat of research, certainly.
Well, when I brought up, you know, does Netflix know, it wasn't the fact that they would shut you down. It was the it was actually quite the opposite, is the fact that she seems so qualified to be doing this kind of work.
Totally.
You know, and I'm wondering if they're like, damn, you know, I can't believe that she actually found this. And it's just uncanny to me. That her expertise seems that it transcends more than just kind of a fun podcast to me.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And she will appreciate that as well. You know, she gets her hands on police reports, on forensics reports, on medical examiner reports, autopsy reports. Like, I don't know how she does it. If you ask her, she'll literally be like, I don't know, I just like Google a lot. Like, she somehow has just managed to find these different avenues. And I will also add that she has also started reading and learning. She bought a bunch of books about forensics because she was like, well, I want to learn more about how to properly read these reports. So I fully understand everything that I'm reading. And I'm like, you're a machine. This is amazing.
So I didn't realize that some of this stuff is just so accessible. Like, where does she find this stuff?
A lot of it is public record. Now, again, I can't speak to exactly physically where she finds it. But again, if you dig deep enough, and I guess you know how to look for it, you can find a lot more than you'd realize, because a lot of things are public record. Now, last night we were recording an episode of the show, which is the Washington Insider murder. And unfortunately with that, a bunch of the medical report, the autopsy report, is under lock and key. So that was a first for her, because normally she can get a hold of that information, but in that case she couldn't, which again is very suspect. So yeah, you'd be surprised what you can find. I think most people just aren't looking for it. You know what I mean?
So have you thought about branching out and maybe doing some Dateline NBC? Because I do love Keith Morrison an awful lot. He's a fellow Canadian, right?
Absolutely. Now listen, it's so funny you bring up Dateline, because not next week's episode of the podcast, but the week after, we are doing our first Dateline mystery.
Nice.
Because wow. I was watching one for pleasure, because I'm obsessed with this stuff. And there was a case that I was like, oh my gosh, it was a more recent case. And I watched it and I thought, Christy, you've got to get on this. Like to your point, I feel like, I was like, I think you really have a chance to maybe find something out about this. Again, it was a crime that was committed within the past couple of years. They have a suspect, but they just can't find the evidence. And so I was like, listen, I know you're busy. I know you're doing a million different things for this podcast. Also, you know, being a mother of three. But if you have time, just watch this episode of Dateline. Tell me what you think. The next text I get from her is, when are we doing this? So
yeah,
it's on the schedule, which I'm very excited
about. Well, the Keith Morrison thing is just fantastic, because, you know, he's got that voice. And
that voice,
meanwhile,
yeah.
Next door... Mr. Robinson wasn't who people thought he was.
Right.
Speaking of impressions, that's pretty good. I like it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I got to tell you, I got
to
tell you, years ago, I went to Spain with a girlfriend of mine that I grew up with, and we went to a post office, and they had a wanted poster of like five guys, and it was entitled Personas Peligroso, obviously people who are dangerous.
Right.
So later on in the day, we went to, it's called a Telefonica, where this was before cell phones, and you would go and make international calls. So while we're there, I took, you know, Spanish for like 2 years in junior high school. So we're inside and I look and I see a guy walking around the Telefonica who I swear was on that wanted poster.
He was Peligrosos?
He was Personas Peligroso.
Whoa! So
there was a security guard there and I went over in my broken Spanish and I was like, aquí, aquí, you know, pointing. but I have to be careful because I don't want the guy to see that I'm pointing him out. And the security guard looked at me like I was completely insane. I thought he was going to drag me out of the Telefonica. I went to the woman at the desk to tell her to plead my case, and they're all looking at me like I'm insane. And I tell you, to this day, I know it was the guy. And I was thinking, could you imagine I'm an American just traveling in Spain, and I find the guy who's on the poster? and the guy left.
Oh,
and
wow.
You'll never
and got away, escaped.
And got away.
Yeah.
Listen, you did your best. You tried. There's nothing else you can do.
I know.
So you're drinking for every episode. And I thought, well, I mean, we should probably be drinking something. So I did a very stiff Bloody Mary here with fresh horseradish. And I'm killing that sucker. Sue, are you drinking?
Actually, I had a protein shake with a little vodka.
A little vodka in the protein
shake.
Oh, I like
very
your
nice. Style. I like your style. That's amazing.
So I've heard some of your past interviews, and you talked about some bad dates that you've had. I'm wondering, are you still I think this is an okay question to ask. Are you still a single person?
Yes. No, it is an okay question to ask. And no, I'm not. So thank goodness that chapter is closed.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Especially now.
Yeah, now.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I hear from my single friends during this time, and it is such a wild world. You know, that people are dating over Zoom, and it's, you know, raises a bunch of questions about what you have to disclose about if you're dating other people and all of those things, obviously, because, you know, you don't want to put other people at risk. So, yeah, it sounds like quite a mess.
I can't even imagine, you know, because, I mean, I remember phone sex, but Zoom sex, I can't even.
Sue, did you do a lot of phone sex?
You know, I actually did a lot of phone sex because I was a comedian on the road.
Oh!
And my big joke was that I lived in an apartment, and so people could hear me, but they would never, ever see anybody enter or leave my apartment. So that was kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah. I love that.
Well, listen, Lauren, it's great meeting you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
The show is called Superstore. And of course, it's on NBC. The True Crime and Cocktails podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're a true crime fan or a fan of cocktails, this is absolutely perfect. Lauren, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it as well.
And there you have it, Lauren Ash, a fine improv comedian. Different from you, Sue, an improv comedian and a stand-up comedian, obviously two different things. Did you ever do improv?
I did do improv, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, there was an improv group in New York called Chicago City Limits.
Okay.
And they used to book comedians they would do like their first set, and then in between, during intermission, not intermission, but after intermission, they would have a comedian come up and do their act, and then the comedian would join them in their second part of improv.
Ah, got it.
That was great. It was so much fun.
Yeah. And were you good at it?
Yeah, I was very good at it.
Yeah, I'm sure you were. You're generally a very funny person. That's my experience.
Generally
very funny.
Well,
generally
you,
very funny. So I made reference to something there, and I have to make this confession. So one of the performances of my life, and Sue, I started as an actor, right? I was going to be an actor. I was accepted to Yale Drama School, all that stuff. I was very, very serious about it. And I still go back and will occasionally sing Henry Higgins, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face. Would you like to hear a little?
Of course.
Damn, 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 damn. I've grown accustomed to her face. She almost makes the day begin. She likes to whistle night to noon. And I drop the line. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in. There's a little bit.
Wow.
What do you think?
Bravo.
Yeah, I could probably go back to, I'd like to get back on the boards. I always tell Bryan Cranston this. He laughs at me. I say, I'd like to get back on the boards.
What does that mean?
Back on stage, back in the theater, back in the live theater.
Okay, back on the boards. I've never
back
heard
on the
that
boards,
before.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what has been going on in the life of Sue?
The life of Sue, I haven't been going out and golfing. I took a little bit of break from going out on the course, and I've just been just working on my swing. So I've been going to the driving range a lot.
Got it.
And aside from that, you know, writing and...
Sounds exciting.
Sounds exciting. For me, it is, because, well, you don't golf.
Yeah, I don't golf.
So what are you doing to be able to go to the driving range every day is great.
What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
Tom and I are having Kathy Ladman and her husband over.
Nice.
Just the four of us, a little dinner out in the backyard.
Social distanced.
Little social distancing. But, you know, I see Kathy quite often.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, we're kind of like, it's kind of like we live together in a way.
It was so sad. The other night I'm talking to my mom, and she, of course, is getting ready for Thanksgiving, and everybody's all excited, and not stepdad Leo, my mom's boyfriend, is all excited because he's going to bring home prime rib from his club, and that's what we're going to have for Thanksgiving dinner. And I talked to my mom this week, and she sounded hesitant, and I sounded hesitant, and then we just called the whole thing off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I got actually a text from Tom's niece. She wanted to come out and visit some friends. She lives in Florida where Tom's family lives.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I have an extra plane ticket. And, you know, I was thinking maybe I'll, you know, have grandma, Tom's mom, you know, come with me. And I'm like, you know, I'd love to see her. But I don't think that's a good idea.
No, not with older people, not at all.
No, flying on a plane from Florida to here with a mask, and, you know, she's like, you know, in her mid-80s, and like, that is never going
to
happen.
Well, I went to the World Series, but I wore one of those N95 masks the entire, I guess you can't be overly careful, but I was as careful as you possibly could be. And thankfully, I'm now, 2 weeks out, so I came back clean.
Now, when you came back, did you have to quarantine like there and back?
No. I came home because Dallas and California, we're not quarantining between states. Only some states have got quarantines. Like I think Pennsylvania's got one. Canada has got a quarantine. We're not allowed to go to Canada. But no, there's no quarantine between California and Dallas.
Okay. Now, how close were you sitting to people at the stadium?
I was probably 6 feet on each side, and I was definitely very, very safe. I was in an auxiliary press box. I wasn't with fans. It was outdoors, but there was a row of press, probably, you know, 10 people long down a really, really long bench. So I was very safe in that way and very safe. I left that N95 mask on the entire time I was on the plane. I did not even drink water while I was on the plane because I didn't want to take my mask off. So came back clean, which was great. Everybody made everybody nervous. And Thanksgiving, I was doing, I'll just tell you, frankly, I was doing a commercial and on the show, and the commercial said, hey, it's time to pile all your kids into the car and go off for Thanksgiving. And I'm like, boy, that is so tone deaf. I am going to edit that commercial.
Yeah.
Just not the right way to approach it. And I'll be honest with you, Sue, and I am just so fucking sick of this pandemic.
Yeah, I know.
I am so tired of it. And I keep hearing, all right, so maybe 6 months away, 7 months away, 8 months away, things will go back to normal. I haven't been to work in 9 months and doing the show from my house. I just will be so, the world will be so new and fresh and happy when this thing all ends.
Right. No, I know. It's like I still can't believe it's happening. Like whenever I walk into a store and I look around and I see all these people wearing masks, I'm like, what the fuck? You know, it's like, I still can't believe it.
Right. It's crazy. I want another crack at Henry Higgins. You ready?
Really?
Yeah, I want another crack because I screwed
up
the lines.
We're going with that take.
No, I know we're going with that take, but I want to do a better take.
All right.
Okay. Damn. I've grown accustomed to a face. She nearly makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune she whistles night and noon, her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs, a second nature to me now, like breathing out and breathing in. There you go.
You're like the last person in the world I thought was going to pull that out.
You know, the drama teacher back in high school chose a musical where somebody could talk sing just for me. I'm a very good talk singer. I'm not a very good singer.
Okay, so you're not really a triple threat. You're like
I'm
a two
not.
And a, you're like a double and a half threat.
Double and a half, exactly. I can't dance either.
So well, I'm really just. And I guess you're a single and a half.
I'm a single threat. all right, so Sue, you ready? It's time.
It's time for Jacob.
Yep, you've heard me talk about the law offices of Jacob Imrani. In fact, you've seen his billboards, and you drive around town. You see his commercials on TV. Now, I've met Jacob. Know Jacob. He's a friend of mine. He puts passion and compassion into each and every client. And over the past few years, Jacob was getting so many calls from people who already had a case, and he's created a second opinion department for them. That's right. If you currently have an accident case or you're trying to deal with the insurance company on your own, call Jacob for a free, that's right, free second opinion. Jacob Imrani has been doing this for 24 years. You can count on Jacob, his team, their experience to properly guide you through the process. When dealing with something as important as an accident, your health and well-being, call Jacob. Make sure you're getting the care and the help that you deserve. For a free, that's right, free consultation, call 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. 844-24-JACOB, or remember the jingle.
All right, before we go into the jingle,
yes,
Jacob may be hearing from my husband because my husband got rear-ended.
No.
Earlier this week, and it was a really, really bad accident. I'll send you the photo of the crash.
Is he okay?
He's fine. He's very, very lucky.
Should I patch in Jacob right now?
But he's fine, and the treat today is a song, is the jingle sung by my husband Tom.
Wow. Okay, great. I'm excited about this.
Okay, yep. Here we go.
Accident or injury, call Jacob. Imrani, call Jacob.
There you go. Played kind of fast and loose with the notes there, but he's just been hit in the head, so that's understandable.
I said to him, I told him I really wanted him to sing it like Kevin Meaney, like old Jacob, and do like a little kind of like loungy singer.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's very good. I like that a lot. Jacob Imrani, we thank him for his sponsorship. We thank Lauren Ash for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review to the Culture Pop podcast. All kinds of great stuff coming up. Sue, what do you got planned the rest of the weekend?
The rest of the weekend, golf, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm actually reading a book that I cannot believe I never read called The Writer's Journey, because I'm writing something right now. And it's like the Bible for writers. So
wow.
I'm going to be reading that this weekend and, having dinner at home with my hubby and my
golf
dog.
And The Writer's Journey. I want to party with you. Well, all right. We will see you next time on the Culture Pop Podcast.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all new episode of Culture Pop.